Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on where your defense dollars go right after this message. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. He was the former editor of the New York Tribune. Here's what he said to the New York Press Association back in February of 1936. He said, "There's no such thing as a free and independent press in America unless it's in some country town. And there's not one of you who dares express an honest opinion because you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid $150 a week for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for doing similar things. Our business is to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, to sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are," he said, "the tools of rich men behind the scenes." Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program of this New World Order. Men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, the Bushes, the Bundys, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, entertaining, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send your email request. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Tonight's report comes from the Calamity Howler. The Calamity Howler is published by A.V. Krebs at earthlink.net. To receive your newsletter, The Calamity Howler, if you will email A.V. Krebs at earthlink.net, the newsletter comes out free. Now, Krebs finances both the Calamity Howler and the Agriculture Examiner by free will offerings or donations, however you want to word it. I send $25 a month. At $25 a month, you receive 104 issues. It's a weekly newsletter, The Calamity Howler and the Agribusiness Examiner. That totals 104 issues for $300 a year. It's $2.88 per issue, and it's 17 pages per issue, or about 17 cents per page. It's probably one of the best values in newsletters in the country. A.V. Krebs at earthlink.net. Well, the Pentagon is spending a lot of money without bids, a study finds. Now, more than 40% of Pentagon business, 40%. Of Pentagon business, a total of $362 billion has been awarded on a no-bid basis over the last 6 years, according to a report issued Wednesday that showed that the biggest companies won the bulk of their contracts without going through any competitive process. The nation's largest military contractor, the Lockheed Martin Corporation, received the most Pentagon business on a non-competitive basis. 74%, that's 74% of Lockheed's $94 billion in Pentagon contracts received since fiscal 1998 was awarded without competition, according to the report, which was written by the Center for Public Integrity, a Washington nonprofit group that studied 2.2 million Pentagon contracts worth a collective $900 billion. Competitive bidding at the Pentagon happens less often than we think, and this no-bid controversy surrounding Halliburton in Iraq actually is, unfortunately, not an aberration, or so said Charles Lewis, the center's executive director. Now, Mr. Lewis's organization was one of the first to study contracts won by Halliburton and other companies in Iraq and Afghanistan, and today's report grew out of that earlier work. At Boeing, the nation's second largest contractor, 60% Of the $81 billion in Pentagon contracts since 1998 that has gone to the Boeing company, was awarded without any competition, as was 67% at the number three contractor, the Raytheon company, which received $40 billion in contracts over the same period. Of the nation's top 10 military contractors, nine won more than half of their Pentagon contract dollars through non-competitive awards. That is, without a doubt, pure fascism. Thomas C. Greer, a Lockheed spokesman, said that because of the substantial investment and lengthy development cycles followed by limited annual production quantities, competitive bidding for Pentagon contracts is often not cost-effective. Nevertheless, it is important to note that sole-source awards still mandate contractor performance, Mr. Greer said. In addition, the report said that because of military-industry consolidation, 80% of all Pentagon contracting dollars were won by the top 1% of all contractors over the six-year period. Let me repeat that. 80% of all of the Pentagon contracting was won by the top 1% of the contractors over the six-year period. So 1% of the contractors do 80% of the business, and they don't have to bid for it. Then 99% of all of the contractors do 20% of the remaining business with the Pentagon. Now, currently, for instance, half of the military budget is outsourced to contractors, while oversight of these contracts has declined, the report said. The Pentagon has reduced the number of government officials who supervise contractors and instead hiring contractors to oversee and manage others, according to the report. The Pentagon hired a contractor to determine how many contractors that it had employed, the report said. There's an even more fundamental problem underscoring our entire investigation: the stunning lack of accountability, said Mr. Lewis. This is a Keystone Cop situation where no one is monitoring the monitors. This is a very serious situation, and the Pentagon is treating it like a hair in your soup. Glenn Flood, a Pentagon spokesman, said that the center's accusations have been made before. Mr. Flood said that much of the Pentagon's business is so specialized that it is impossible to find more than one supplier. Industry consolidation has also accelerated the non-competitive trend, he said. Where do you go if you want or need a subcontractor or a joint strike fighter, said Mr. Flood. The mergers of the 1980s have taken their toll. You have only five or six major contractors, so where do you go? But the center's report said that the great growth in outsourcing is taking place in providing services, not in the production of weapon systems. This includes items like the interrogations at Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, helping to write the Bush administration's military budget and devising strategic plans at the same time. Military contractors have become skilled at Washington politics and in providing jobs for Pentagon officials after they leave the government. The leading recipient of campaign donations from military contractors has been President Bush, with $5.4 million that came from the industry since 1998. Military contractors, however, began stepping up contributions to Senator John Kerry after he won the Iowa caucuses, the report also said. And before the caucuses, Senator Kerry had received $332,000 from the industry. He has received just under $2 million since then. The Republican Party has received $62 million from the defense industry since 1998, compared to $24 million for the Democratic Party, according to the report. Richard L. Abloufia, a military industry analyst at the Teal Group, a consulting firm in Fairfax, Virginia, said that Pentagon outsourcing is often neither the cheapest nor the most efficient approach. I think it's time for a comprehensive rethink of this trend, Mr. Abloufia said. A lot of it is done to produce short-term numbers that reduce the size of government, and that always is pleasing to voters. But I'm not sure it's the best strategic decision. There's a terrific emphasis on cutting the numbers, and to do that, you need outsourcing to make the numbers look good. But how much of that is just window dressing? Now, there's also been a vast arms buildup, not yet enough for wars, but a vast arms buildup. And amid one of the greatest military spending increases in history, the Pentagon is starved for cash. That's right. The United States will spend more than $500 billion on national security in the year beginning October the 1st. That represents a high water mark, and it is creating boom times in the armaments industry. Yet the military says that it has run $1 billion a month short over the last year, paying for the basics of war, fighting in Iraq, troops, equipment, spare parts, and training. Now, the disparity between spending on the arsenals of the future and the armies of today is great, and it is growing. The Pentagon will spend $144 billion in the coming year researching and building weapons for future wars, another record, and twice the annual costs of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by most independent estimates. Now, the Pentagon says that it has 77 major weapons programs under development. These weapons programs include the $200 billion Joint Strike Fighter project, a fleet of next-generation aircraft, a $112 billion Army program to create networks of weapons and communication systems, and an experimental Navy destroyer, the world's first $10 billion warship. That's not an aircraft carrier, it's a Navy destroyer, and it's going to cost $10 billion. Those 77 armed systems have a collective price tag of $1.3 trillion. That's nearly twice what they were supposed to cost and 11 times the yearly bill for operating and maintaining the American military. Well, we got to take a break here, so stand by and we'll be back with more on where your defense dollars go when we return, right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, tonight's report, Where Your Defense Dollars Go. This is a report from the Calamity Howler, published by A.V. Krebs at earthlink.net. Again, that's A.V. Krebs, A-V-K-R-E-B-S, at earthlink.net. The spike in weapons spending is a bonanza for the nation's armaments contractors, almost all of which report surging profits and soaring stock prices. The shares of Lockheed Martin, the nation's largest military contractor, have more than tripled since their low in early 2000. Northrop Grumman's are up some 165%. Since the beginning of 2001, prime Pentagon contracts awarded to the top 10 arms makers have nearly doubled to $82.3 billion in 2003. Lockheed's sales have risen over that period to $31.8 billion from $24 billion, and Northrop's are up to $26.2 billion from $13 billion. They've doubled. A Lockheed Martin spokesman, Thomas Jurkowski, said the company's success since 2000 came from the changed geopolitical landscape in which Lockheed helped the Pentagon meet the demands that have been placed on it by providing a broad range of advanced technologies and capabilities. The rise in Pentagon spending is the greatest in 20 years, nearly matching the buildup that President Ronald Reagan initiated in the early 1980s. Spending went up $100 billion, that's about $170 billion in today's dollars during Mr. Reagan's first term, to $276 billion, or translated in today's dollars, that's about $464 billion today. It started rising sharply again in 1999 and has increased by $148 billion since then, not counting the costs for the war in Iraq. But when it comes to fighting the wars, the money has not flowed very freely. In 1999, while running for president, George W. Bush proposed a new direction for national defense, away from an industrial era of Cold War planes, tanks, and ships, toward an information era of wired, speedier, stealthier forces. "I will defend the American people against missiles and terror," he said then. "I will begin creating the military of the next century," unquote. President Bush. The arms industry gave nearly $9 million to Republican candidates in 2000, twice as much as to Democrats, expecting that Republicans would significantly increase Pentagon spending, which they have indeed done. The stock market value of military contractors began rising that year. As the public and investors became aware that George Bush had a good chance of becoming president, defense stocks began going up right away. Or so said Paul Nesbitt of the JSA Research in Newport, Rhode Island, who has analyzed the industry for more than 30 years, and it looked very much like the situation when Reagan came into office. But President Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld soon faced a quandary. "There is no question that we probably cannot afford every weapon system in development," Mr. Bush said in August of 2001. "This administration is going to have to winnow them down. Would they rebuild the arsenal they had or skip forward to the next generation of weapons?" On September the 10th, 2001, Rumsfeld faced a totally invidious choice, said Gordon A. Adams, who oversaw national security spending at the Office of Management and Budget under President Bill Clinton. He had to choose between the present and the future, and he knew it, Mr. Adams said. The Pentagon planning system was in a crunch. The budget was in severe stress. But overnight, the terrorist attacks of September 11th completely changed the planning horizon for the Defense Department, Mr. Adams said, adding that the floodgates opened, and everything from that point on was a priority. For the coming year, the Pentagon will spend at least $420 billion, not counting the costs of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, which will run at least another $72 billion and probably more, according to congressional staff members. Adding $32 billion for Homeland Security, the bottom line comes to $524 billion, apart from the mandatory bills for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and other payments to individuals that exceeds the combined cost of running the rest of the federal government. The accelerating pace of arms spending is unlikely to slow noticeably, no matter who wins the election on November the 2nd. President Bush supports all 77 major weapons systems now under development, and Senator John Kerry has said that he would cut back on one, missile defense, which costs $10 billion a year, and use the money for more troops. Why is there plenty of money available for the weapons of the future, but not enough for the troops at war today? Well, that's because military experts say one thing did not change after 9/11, and that is the way the Pentagon and Congress spend money to pay for wars. We pay for war with supplementals, or special requests to Congress, said Lieutenant Colonel Rose Ann Lynch, a Pentagon public affairs officer. We do not budget for war. That's the way we do it, and that's the way we've been doing it for years. Now, despite the record increases in weapons spending, the military, according to the Government Accountability Office, the budget watchdog of Congress, still faced shortfalls of more than $12 billion over the last year for the myriad nuts and bolts of war, supporting troops, buying spare parts, and maintaining equipment. The Army reported the greatest gaps. It estimated this summer that it would run $10.2 billion short in its operations and maintenance accounts in the fiscal year that ended September the 30th. At least $8 billion of this reflected the basic needs of soldiers at war in Iraq, like refurbishing and maintaining equipment, the GAO reported. The military is trying to cover these costs by reducing training for troops and deferring equipment maintenance, both of which cut into military readiness. The Pentagon has consistently understated the costs of combat. The cost of operating in Iraq has clearly exceeded the original estimate, said Dov S. Zakheim, the Pentagon's controller and chief financial officer from April 2001. To May of 2004. The number of troops have gone up. We originally estimated some kind of steady state, a leveling off, maybe even a dropping off of forces. When the war fighting money runs dry, the Pentagon taps into operations accounts and seeks tens of billions of dollars in emergency funding, spending them as fast as they're approved by Congress, sometimes even faster. The military has been under-reporting the actual costs of war in Iraq, said Mr. Adams, now director of security policy studies at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. And as a consequence, he added, the Pentagon is led to raiding the operations and maintenance accounts, which is mortgaging the future. The war in Iraq started before the White House sought money to pay for it, and its financing has been patched together on the run, said Winslow T. Wheeler, who has spent 31 years as a military spending analyst for Republican and Democratic senators. When the war began, the president had failed to ask for money to fund it. He said, to go to war, we canceled training, slowed down equipment maintenance, just the kind of thing that you want to be goosing up in wartime. But back home, Congress continues to enjoy the political prerequisites commonly known as pork, taking billions from the Pentagon for pet projects at home. The way Congress pays for all of this is by raiding other accounts, specifically for military training, spare parts, and maintenance, said Mr. Wheeler, whose new book, The Wastrels of Defense, published by the Navy Institute Press, will be published in October. Mr. Zakheim, the former Pentagon controller, agreed that the cultural traditions of Capitol Hill include underfinancing, paying for the rest by shifting money from the Pentagon's operating accounts. Congress, he added, has not done away with the culture since 9/11. The result is an army scraping for spare parts and combat-ready equipment while Pentagon officials continue to pour money into futuristic new weapons and the accounts of military contractors building them. The Pentagon's budget is actual outlays, or in actual outlays, is now nearly 10 times as great as any other nation's in the world. The American arsenal can overwhelm just about any opponent in a conventional war, as it did in vanquishing the Iraqi army and toppling Saddam Hussein. But whether it holds the right mixture of weapons for fighting long-term battles with the enemy of today looks much more questionable. The Pentagon soon may be forced to rethink its priorities for both weapons and spending, said Lauren Thompson. He's the chief operating officer of the Lexington Institute, a nonpartisan research group in Arlington, Virginia. It's harder to justify high-tech weapons, he said, when we seem unable to defeat an adversary fighting with low-tech weapons like car bombs and propelled grenades, which are relatively primitive insurgent tactics. Now, security has been faulted at nuclear reactors. Plants are vulnerable to terrorist attacks, so reports the General Accounting Office. Now, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has failed to take sufficient steps to protect commercial nuclear plants from terrorist attacks, the U.S. Government Accountability Office says. Although nuclear plants are no doubt more secure against a terrorist attack now than they were on September the 11th, 2001, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency security improvements still haven't resolved plant problems that spawned previously exposed embarrassments. For example, security guards sleeping on duty, falsifying of logs. Jim Wells, director of the GAO's Natural Resources and Environment Division, said in congressional testimony on Tuesday. And Wells' remarks to the House Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats and International Relations were also issued in report form by the GAO, which was formerly known as the General Accounting Office. Well, hang on, we got to take a break here. We'll be back with more on the vulnerability to terrorist attacks right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Tonight's report, Where Your Defense Dollars Go. You know, the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and the New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion. Jesus of Nazareth held that same view when he said in Matthew 24, verse 22, quote, "Except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive," unquote. Now, there are 64 life-threatening problems described in the scripture detailing this New World Order and their Global 2000 genocide plan. And the scripture teaches preparation for this great tribulation, not apathy and indifference. It's time that you and I get wise and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians like Ted Kennedy and Arlen Specter and Hillary, or that guy John in the Justice Department. And let's prepare to live through and survive this Global 2000 New World Order nightmare. Now, to do just that, why don't you call, write, or email the law school and ask for those 64 life-threatening problems from the scriptures? And then let's talk about formulating a real, meaningful, intelligent plan to survive Global 2000 and these other 64 life-threatening problems called the Great Tribulation in the scripture. Just call and order my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's the place to start. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org and click onto the email machine and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Calamity Howler newsletter. Tonight's program comes from the Calamity Howler, published by avkrebs at earthlink.net. If you want a copy, just send your name and address. Email avkrebs at earthlink.net and ask for yours. The GAO report upset committee chair Representative Christopher Shays. He's a representative, a Republican from Connecticut, who criticized the NRC's sluggishness in implementing post-September 11th security reforms. People who live near nuclear reactors and those farther downwind take little comfort from a cozy, indulgent regulatory process that looks and acts very much like business as usual. Shea said in a statement Tuesday, findings of security violations elicit promises of correction, but very little NRC follow-up. Emergency response plans for nuclear disasters may not be current. And Wells' comments also suggested a potential conflict of interest in how simulations of terrorist attacks are conducted. The potential conflict arises, he stated, from the fact that the NRC, that's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is considering hiring the terrorist impersonators. Terrorist impersonators from a firm that was selected by the Nuclear Industry's own trade association. It's the Nuclear Energy Institute, and that already provides security guards to half the plants where such exercises are to be conducted. Now, the company's relationship with the nuclear industry raises questions about the mock terrorist forces' independence. Wells' report says the GAO report does not identify the company by name, and it could not be determined Tuesday. Shays concurred a proposal to hire an attacking force from the same company used to protect several nuclear plants raises legitimate concerns about the integrity of future simulated attacks. Wells also noted that some employees of the same company have been suspected of cheating in past tests, according to the GAO report. And during a June 2003 Department of Energy force-on-force exercise, that's called a simulated attack, at a nuclear site at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, security guards working for this company received uncharacteristically high scores, the report states. Subsequent investigations by the Department of Energy Inspector General uncovered the possibility that guards might have cheated on tests as far back as the mid-1980s. And it's been alleged that the guards had studied plans for the simulated attacks before they were carried out, had disabled the laser sensors they wore during tests to determine when they were shot by mock enemies, arranged trucks and other obstacles to help foil simulated attacks, created special non-standard plans to help them perform better on tests, and put more guards on duty at the time of the tests than would normally have been present, Wells said. Now, officials at the lab, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, couldn't be reached for comment. Wells also said that unidentified Nuclear Regulatory Commission officials believe certain types of aircraft hitting nuclear facilities at certain locations pose some risks of damaging those facilities. And earlier this summer, a veteran anti-nuclear group filed a petition with the NRC asking it to consider surrounding the nation's nuclear plants with low-cost arrays of steel girders, mesh netting, and cable barriers. Ideally, these barriers, beam hinge shields, an allusion to England's Stonehenge monument, could destroy an incoming plane before it rammed the plant, says the petition filed by the group, the Los Angeles-based Committee to Bridge the Gap. The organization, which claims 1,500 members, has opposed the nuclear industry since 1979. Now, NRC Chair Nils Diaz addressed the issue September 8th in a letter to U.S. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge. The letter, recently posted at the NRC's website, assures Ridge that in an aircraft incident, the likelihood of both damaging the reactor core and releasing radioactivity that could affect public health and safety is very low. Even if an aircraft managed to damage the plant, the NRC has ways of mitigating the health and environmental consequences, Diaz added, without giving any specifics. Now, the president of Bridge the Gap, Daniel Hirsch of Santa Cruz, California, replied Tuesday, quote, the Diaz letter sounds as though it is from the Alfred E. Newman School of Bureaucracy, published at Mad Magazine, which takes four pages to say, what me worry? The chairman of the NRC continues to fail to appreciate the era that we now live in since September the 11th. And meanwhile, the NRC has stopped posting an online scorecard that rated the quality of security at each of the nation's 65 nuclear power plants. The scorecard disappeared from the NRC's website August 4th. The agency reiterated its decision to drop the site in a statement issued on Monday. The statement quotes Diaz as saying the site was removed to protect the public health and safety because such sensitive information might be misused by those that wish us harm. The findings. Well, among the concerns raised in congressional testimony by Government Accountability Office official Jim Wells, first, a potential conflict of interest could undermine the credibility of exercises designed to test a plant security, as the NRC is considering hiring a mock assault team trained in terrorist tactics from a company that already provides guards for about half of the facilities to be tested. Second, unidentified NRC officials believe certain types of aircraft hitting nuclear facilities at certain locations pose some risks of damaging those plants. However, these same officials believe that there would be sufficient time to implement emergency preparedness plans if necessary to protect the public. Third, the NRC's review of improved security plans has primarily been a paper review that fails to note vital information, such as where guards are based and how they would maneuver in case of a terrorist attack. Fourth, officials are generally not visiting the nuclear plants for a first-hand look. And finally, the NRC is not following up to ensure that previous security violations have been corrected or that the resulting lessons learned are relayed to officials at other nuclear plants. Talking about America's respect around the world, as a result of the American military, President Bush declared last week the Taliban is no longer in existence. Well, it's unclear whether Mr. Bush has simply misspoke or whether he really is that clueless. But his claim was in keeping with his re-election strategy, demonstrated once again in last night's debate. A president who has done immense damage to America's position in the world hopes to brazen it out by claiming that failure is in reality a great success. Well, 3 years ago, the United States was both feared and respected, feared because of its military supremacy and respected because of its traditional commitment to democracy and the rule of law. Well, since then, Iraq has demonstrated the limits of American military power and has tied up much of that power in a grinding guerrilla war. This has emboldened regimes that pose a real threat, such as 3 years ago, would North Korea have felt so free to trumpet its conversion of fuel rods into bombs? But even more important is the loss of respect. After the official rationales for the Iraq war proved false, and after America failed to make good on its promise to foster democracy in either Afghanistan or Iraq, and not least after Abu Ghraib prison, the world no longer believes that we are the good guys in white hats. So let's talk for a minute about Afghanistan, which administration officials tout as a great success story. The administration relies on the public's ignorance. Voters, they believe, do not know that even though the United States promised to provide Afghanistan with both security and aid during its transition to democracy, it broke both of those promises. It has allowed the country to slide back into warlordism and has allowed the Taliban to make a comeback. These days, Mr. Bush and other administration officials often talk about the 10 million Afghans who have registered to vote in this month's election, citing the figure as proof that democracy is making strides after all. And they count on the public not to know, and on reporters not to mention, that the number of people registered considerably exceeds all estimates of the eligible population. And what they call evidence of democracy on the march is actually evidence of large-scale electoral fraud. It's the same story in Iraq. The January election has become the rationale for everything that we're doing there. Yet it's hard to find anyone not beholden to the administration who believes that the election, if it happens at all, will be anything more than a sham. Yet Mr. Bush and his congressional allies seem to have learned nothing from their failures. And if Bush is returned to office, there's every reason to think that they will continue along the same path without much change, sort of like business as usual. All right, hang on. We're going to have to take a break here. And we'll be back on where your defense dollars go, where we're spending about $524 billion a year on defense right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child in the world. Today, it's only 38 days. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, all right, but then we turn around and our grapes are imported from Chile, our tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. And our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 population reduction program. Now, this globalization may be good for business. It may be good for international geopolitical corporations. But globalization is bad for you, and it's bad for me. Back in 1940, we Americans all had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year or more. Today, we Americans have a three-day supply in our refrigerators, and we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all. But over the past 60 years, we've now traded a one-year food supply for 3 days. Now, do you think that's very wise? And these global 2,000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years, so reports the Club of Rome. Now, these evil madmen with their global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for. And I say let them die for their cause and let you and I live for ours. Now, let me show you from the scriptures how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. If you'd like to learn more, just call and order my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number, 417-273-4967. And my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about where your defense dollars go. It's a report from the Calamity Howler and Agribusiness Examiner. It's published by A.V. Krebs. You can get a copy free. All you have to do is send Krebs your email address. It's easy enough to do. It's avkrebs@earthlink.net. A.V. Krebs, spelled just like it sounds, A.V.K.R.E.B.S. @earthlink.net. He puts out this newsletter weekly. There's actually two newsletters that come out. They're 17 pages each. One, a political newsletter on called The Calamity Howler, and the other, The Agribusiness Examiner, a paper which is dedicated to agricultural information. The newsletters come out free of charge. All Krebs asks is that you support him with your voluntary contributions. I suggest $25 a month. That's $300 a year. If you can't afford that, send something. But by all means, avail yourself of the two newsletters. That's avkrebs@earthlink.net. 104 issues for $300 a year. That's $25 a month. Is $2.88 per issue. That's 17 pages per issue. That's about 17 cents per page. All right. Going on, we can readily see one example of this when we look at the question of torture. At the Abu Ghraib prison, it has largely vanished from U.S. political discussion today, largely because the administration and its congressional allies have been so effective at covering up the high-level involvement. But both the revelations and the cover-up did terrible damage to America's moral authority to much of the world. America simply looks like a place where top officials condone and possibly order the torture of innocent people and suffer no consequences for it. What we need is an effort to regain our good name. And what we're getting instead is a provision inserted by congressional Republicans in the Intelligence Reform Bill to legalize extraordinary rendition. That's a euphemism for sending terrorism suspects to countries that use torture for interrogation. This would institutionalize a system under which suspects can be sent at our government's whim to Egypt, Syria, or Jordan, and to fight such a move, it's up to the suspect to prove that he'll be tortured on arrival. Just what we need to convince other countries of our commitment to the rule of law. Now, most Americans simply are not aware of all of this, and the sheer scale of Mr. Bush's foreign policy failures insulates him from its political consequences. Voters aren't ready to believe how badly the war in Iraq is really going, let alone how badly America's moral position in the world has deteriorated. But the rest of the world has already lost faith in us, and in fact, let us make a prediction. If Mr. Bush gets a second term, we'll soon have no democracies left among our lives. No, not even Tony Blair's Britain. Mr. Bush will be left with the support of regimes that don't worry about the legalities, regimes like Putin's Russia. Well, let me give you a quickie here on a study which says 82 firms paid no income taxes. Now, we Americans are supporting the military to the tune of $524 billion. That's in the 2004 fiscal year. In the 2005 fiscal year, that's the one we're in right now, I imagine it'll be another $500 billion spent on defense and defense-related business. I want to point out that even if you take the 3,000 victims of the trade towers and the Pentagon and add them into all the terrorists and terrorist attacks that we've experienced since 1980, it's really a tempest in a teapot. And the amount of money that we're spending as a knee-jerk reaction has nothing to do with a war on terrorism. It has to do with our national economy. You see, the economy needs to be inflated, and the best way to spend money into the economy to inflate it is through war. For instance, the single most important factor in removing us from the depression of the 1930s and into the boom times of the 40s and 50s was World War II. So war is a vehicle that is used to pump dollars into circulation, and the purpose for having no-bid contracts, and keep in mind that President Bush has not vetoed a single spending bill. We're not here to save money, boys and girls. We're here to inflate the economy by $4.5 trillion by the end of 2005. In 1987, I believe it was, the total amount of dollars in circulation, American dollars in circulation, was $3.5 billion, grew to $9 billion by the year 2000 or thereabouts, and they're moving it from $9 billion to $13.5 billion. Excuse me, I said billion, it's trillion. 3.5 trillion in 87, up to 9 trillion in 2000, up to 13.5 trillion by the year, the end of next year, 2005. Now listen to this. A new study released Wednesday said that 82 of the United States' largest profitable corporation paid no federal income tax during at least 1 year in the last 3 years of the Bush administration. The study by Citizens for Tax Justice, a labor-funded think tank, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, was released by a Capitol Hill news conference featuring Representative Lloyd Doggett, Democrat of Texas, a persistent critic of corporate tax shelters. Now, these corporate tax shelters are sheltering the biggest corporations in America and the most profitable of the Fortune 500 corporations. The study examined 275 profitable Fortune 500 corporations with total profits of $1.1 trillion during the first 3 years of the Bush administration. It found one-third of the 275 companies paid zero or less in federal income taxes in at least 1 year from 2001 to 2003, and it blamed the use of corporate tax shelters, a corporate tax benefit to boost depreciation and other tax avoidance strategies, for this trend. The sharp increase in the number of tax-avoiding companies reflects the results of aggressive corporate lobbying and a White House and a Congress eager to do the lobbyists' bidding. So said Robert McIntyre. He's the director of Citizens for Tax Justice. Now, in the 3 years that these 82 companies paid no income tax, they reported $102 billion in pre-tax U.S. profits. But instead of paying the $35.6 billion in income taxes at the 35% corporate income tax rate, these companies generated so many excess tax loopholes, tax breaks, tax loopholes, that they received outright rebate checks from the United States Treasury totaling $12.6 billion, the study found. General Electric Company had a $9.5 billion total tax break during the three-year period, topping the list of companies with the largest total tax breaks. It was followed by SBC Communications with $9 billion, Citigroup with $4.6 billion, and International Business Machines with $4.6 billion. The study examined a corporate tax benefit in the 2002 and 2003 tax bills to boost accelerated depreciation for companies, which was designed to encourage new investment in plant and equipment. And the study finds that these companies failed to do so. Instead, it found the 25 companies reporting the largest tax savings from accelerated depreciation cut their total property, plant, and equipment investments by 27% from 2001 to 2003. So I just thought you'd like to know where your tax dollars are going. Now remember that some of these biggest Fortune 500 companies are the defense contractors who are no-bid companies and pay no income tax on their profits. Here's one more quickie. Did you know, for instance, that the 535 members of Congress, the Senate and House of Representatives, of those 535 members, only one has a child or a son or daughter in the war in Iraq? Only one. All right, these politically incorrect opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers and sponsors, the staff, or the management of the network, or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, I'm going to have to leave it right there. That's the signal. It says my time is up. Well, I have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.